This podcast is sponsored by Rask Invest, Owen's complete guide to money and investing. Rask Invest members receive Owen's official investment ideas, research on budgets, banking, super and insurance, plus how-to guides to get started. Visit the Rask Finance website to learn more and join today.
Hello and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's Financial Services Guide on the Rask Finance website. Ben McGarry is the founder of Totus Capital. The Latin word for Totus means absolute. It's a fitting name because Ben is now one of Australia's leading hedge fund managers, having been thrust into the spotlight following a number of high-profile sell-offs and corporate collapses, such as ABC Learning. Upon graduating from the University of Queensland with a commerce degree, Ben went to work at a large accounting firm to master his technical skills before moving to London to start investing. In this episode, Ben talks about the experiences that shaped his investment philosophy before going into detail on the key things he looks for when short-selling Aussie companies. Ben and I talk at length about business, big economic issues, some infamous corporate events, and the success of Totus to date. Given the nature of this conversation, if you're new to the world of hedge funds, it may be worth stopping by the Rask Finance website where we've created a free short video course addressing some of the concepts discussed in this episode. This is a rare chance to learn from one of the sharpest thinkers in the game, so I trust you'll enjoy this conversation with Ben McGarry of Totus Capital. Let's just start off, Ben, by saying welcome to the show.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks for having me.
From the outside, it seems to me that you have had some great experiences early in life, some really good jobs, and then progressing up to starting your own business. But even before you started Totus Capital and how successful it has been now, there's some great nuggets and pearls of wisdom that we can draw out from those experiences. So I'm going to start where we always start and ask you to cast your mind back to when you were younger. I suppose, when did you buy your first share, or when did that spark go off and you think, okay, finance is for me?
That's a good question, Owen. I grew up in Brisbane, where I suppose funds management and the financial services industry wasn't as big as it is in Sydney and Melbourne. My father was in small business, and some of his close friends had done well in small business. So I was interested in, you know, how people did well and why they did well. And investing and owning shares seemed a good way of learning about, you know, which businesses were good, bad, and indifferent. And I was very interested in investing, I suppose, from about university time, where I studied commerce and economics at the University of Queensland, and bought my first shares, you know, with savings from working at as a pizza delivery driver for Domino's, a company we still look at all these years later. And started investing alongside my dad as a sort of hobby. Dad's a keen golfer. Nice. I'm not much good at golf, and it was something we could do together. So that was where I started investing.
Do you remember the first share you bought?
I do. It was a gold share called Carpenter Pacific, which was exploring for gold in Papua New Guinea. And my girlfriend's brother and a few close friends were excited about this and researched the hell out of it. And it might be one of the reasons why we steer clear of gold stocks still to this day. I've managed to avoid making a profit on gold shares for my whole career, and we've just basically cut them out of our process completely. So that was the first share.
Yeah, it seems to be a bit of a binary outcome when you make that first investment. Either you get lucky and you get super overconfident, or it goes the other way. So what kept you going?
Yeah, it was interesting that, you know, the concept of, when things work, you could certainly earn money a lot quicker than you could working at close to the minimum wage, on an hourly rate, as I was at uni. I always found from the study side of things, I liked the economics part of university and how markets worked and how business worked. And so the share market was a logical extension of that, and I kept at it I got a job with Pricewaterhouse as it was back then in 97 in Brisbane, which was a really good training ground in how sort of accounts are put together, the inner mechanics of, you know, the finance function of a range of different businesses. I looked at, you know, timber wholesalers and childcare operators and some financial services businesses. And it was a good grounding, but it was a terrible place to try and, you know, continue my hobby, which was investing, because of the conflicts that you had as a chartered accountant in an organisation like Pricewaterhouse that had clients in all sorts of different industries. There wasn't too many things that you could, you were able to invest in. So when I qualified as a chartered accountant in 99, I decided it was time to, you know, make a move to the research side of the stockbroking industry, and I moved over to London and got a job with Morgan Stanley.
Wonderful. And how did you find that experience? Did you also go over there? Did you want to be more worldly? Or
well, it was one of those things that seemed to be just what everybody did in Brisbane. You know, I had a bunch of mates over there at the time, and I was lucky enough to find an Aussie a few years ahead of me at Morgan Stanley who saw a sort of glimmer of intelligence or optimism or hope, or I'm not sure what he saw, but he offered me a contract role at Morgan Stanley, which turned into an analyst job, which I stuck with for 4 years through what was the tech wreck. Mm-hmm. I joined in late 1999, and it was a real eye-opener in, you know, I suppose, exuberance and, you know, what can go right in an industry, but what can go wrong. And I realised that, you know, the investment industry is highly cyclical, and that, you know, that was one of the reasons that I've gravitated towards long-short investing over the years, is that being able to protect capital in environments like that, you know, a tech bust, or we do have bear markets from time to time, and it's been a long time since we've had one, but working in a part of the industry that was able to thrive regardless of what was going on in markets was going to be a much steadier way to sort of run a career without these gaps every decade or so, as you lost a job because, you know, the markets turned down, and it just didn't seem like a very good way to try and run a career or raise a family or pay a mortgage. So that was a pretty good learning experience.
Yeah, were you shorting? I mean, I bet it would have been. Were you shorting at this stage?
No, yeah. I was doing industrial sell side equity research in building materials and construction stocks in Europe. So it was basically long only investing, but or providing research to long-only investors, but they were highly cyclical industries. So, you know, it was a pretty good background or training in industrials research, which was prices, volumes, currencies. And with my sort of accounting bottom-up background and economic studies at uni, you know, clicked with me. And I managed to survive there until it was time to come back to Australia in the early 2000s, where I got a job with UBS and moved across to doing emerging companies research, which is a really good broad grounding or in research in all sorts of different companies. And most of our team at TOTUS, or the three of us on the research side, have all come out of small company or emerging company research, because you're looking at companies from different industries with different drivers all the time, and it helps, you know, it's a really good place to learn how to weed the good from the bad.
Yeah, and really develop those skills as a fundamental analyst and in a, I suppose, the higher risk quotation marks environment.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think risk capital or emerging companies do attract risk capital. So there's a lot of concepts that come up and the market gets excited about. And over the years, you know, I've been doing emerging companies since 2004. You know, you see a lot of things that the market gets excited about that don't work. And you tend to start asking questions like, you know, if this business is being listed for the first time, why hasn't it been listed anywhere successfully? And, you know, things that you can see that have worked well in other listed environments are much lower risk bet than new things where you're having to pick the next winner. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of, you know, high hopes been dashed in the emerging company space, and you know, that was another reason that long short investing appealed to me, because it was, we could make use of time that was spent on those low quality companies and not just you know, the good companies which are hard to find sometimes.
Yeah for sure. So it was about this time, or the end of towards the end of your career or your time at UBS, you wrote a note on a childcare operator. Can you tell us about the note and the company behind that note?
Oh, yeah. So ABC Learning was the company. That was the first stock I was given to cover at UBS as an emerging companies analyst. And, you know, I looked up the note the other day, and it certainly... We've come a long way and learned a lot since that note was written, but it did sort of highlight that there was a lot of complexity in the business model of ABC Learning. They had they were using some structures to put out assets, and some of their operating expenses were with related parties. They spun out the bricks and mortar assets in the business into a property trust, and the narrative that they told the market was this was to improve their returns profile, but when we actually looked at the numbers, the returns profile was deteriorating dramatically despite supposedly spinning out the low quality assets, and it was just looking at a mismatch between what the numbers were telling us and what the narrative in the market was, and asking some basic questions about, you know, why that was, and following the threads until you had the picture. And the picture, once you followed those threads, didn't look that great, and the note got a bit of attention from holders of the stock and also some hedge funds, and eventually that work got me a job on the buyer side at Ausbil Dexia, who was an investor in ABC Learning at the time.
And did they sell out?
Eventually, they did. They didn't take my word for it, based on the work I'd done on the sell side. But one of the good things about being a shareholder is that you do tend to get very good access to management. You can also you get access to all of the sell side research, the people that really love the stock, the people that really hate the stock, and it was a pretty simple exercise to compare those views and work out which were the stronger views. And that's something we try and always do, you know, to this day, is look at what the competing view is or the alternate view is to what we're doing, and see, you know, if we can't refute, you know, the alternate view, maybe we've got to do a bit more work on our thesis on whether the stocks are long or short. So, look, after getting all of that research together, spending a bunch of time with management, going across to the US and looking at the centres that they'd bought, spending some time with Eddie Groves, you know, I came back and pitched to the investment committee that we should definitely be selling. But the thing that actually got, I think, the sell pitch across the line was looking at what the company had promised to do in terms of earnings in 2007, 3 or 4 years before, and their EPS was miles apart from what they delivered all those years later, and I think that was enough to get the portfolio managers to sell. So they sold 28 million shares at $7.35, and it went bust about 9 or 10 months later.
Wow. So at this point, still no shorting?
No, but it did. I mean, the ABC Learning really opened my eyes to, the opportunity of alpha generation in these under-researched or poorly researched mid-cap companies. And then a lot of the companies that I covered when I worked at UBS were the kind of companies that needed money to grow. And so that was why they were listed. And the investment banks loved covering those kind of companies because they paid fees to raise capital. And when the financial crisis came along in 2008, so I moved to the buy side in 2007, a lot of those companies that were heavily reliant on external funding performed really poorly through that. When markets dislocated, people couldn't raise money. Companies like Trans-Pacific, Alesco, Osenco fell out of bed and had dramatic share price decline. So we still look in the book for shorts that are heavily reliant on external funding or capital to survive, and that's one of the main reasons that we're short Tesla, which is our biggest short in the book at the moment.
Okay, we'll get to that in just a moment in more of your investment philosophy, but let's fast forward a bit from ABC. You decide to launch TOTUS in 2012. I'm curious to know, it seemed like everything was going pretty well for you from a career point of view. What made you think, you know, I'm doing pretty well here, but I'm going to go and start my own thing?
Probably, Owen, as we talked about before, the interview is perhaps a little bit of ignorance. was a blessing back then. But look, I'd always wanted to manage a portfolio. I was an assistant portfolio manager at Matthews Capital, was a sector analyst at Ausbil, so I'd never had the opportunity to really put my ideas to work, and I felt like I had real value add through the financial crisis in terms of some of these businesses that fell apart, the Babcocks and Browns, et cetera, that I wasn't able to really capitalise on for clients. So after years of, you know, investing and saving, I had my mortgage paid and a little bit of capital left over, which I thought was enough buffer to perhaps start, open the doors, and if the numbers were good enough, I would hopefully be able to find some like-minded investors. And if everything went brilliantly in a few years, maybe there was enough to have a living and a career out of it. So I probably, didn't anticipate quite how difficult it would be or how long it would take, but we were lucky enough to have a few good years. We've only had one down year in, I suppose, they're almost seven since we launched, so that's helped. And then over the years, we've been able to, you know, attract some really great people to work at TOTUS, which is really making things a hell of a lot easier these days than it was back then.
How old were you when you decided to launch it?
Good question. I must have been 36. I think it took me a year. 37 was when I launched. Yeah, it was almost a year of licensing and trying to round up those initial investors. You know, if I had a dollar for everybody that said they'd give me some money, we would have started with a fair bit more than we actually started with. I think we had $300,000 day one, $1 million at the end of the first month, and then we had a good first 3 months and got to $5 million, and that pretty much exhausted my sort of friends and family Refidex, and we really had to grind it out with the returns from there. So, so I'm just about to turn 44. We'll have a 7-year track record early next year. So hopefully there's some good runway there, you know, in terms of, you know, portfolio manager golden years still ahead of us, I hope.
Yeah, for sure. That's wonderful. And you paid down the mortgage, you think, okay, let's do it. A lot of people, I think, from the outside underestimate just how much it costs to start, not even a retail fund, just any fund in general. So it is, even though you say $1 million or $5 million, it does take a lot of work to grind that out, as you say. And, you know, eventually with your performance, you know, it was bound to catch on, but it wouldn't have been easy. It would have been a few inward-looking moments in those first few years.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, by the time I think the cash stopped going out, the mortgage was back to, you know, I had a 50% LVR on my house. By the time we got to the, you know, the point where the checks to lawyers and service providers were balanced out by management and performance fees. Then for the first few years, really, it was only the performance fee. The management fee really was a rounding error. And every time we got to a point where the management fee was sufficient, we hired another person. So Sam Granger joined when the fund was $13 million. He effectively got my salary, and it's been pretty much the same ever since. So we've, you know, the positive is that we've invested and got a really good team around us now.
Yeah, indeed you do. So let's talk about the strategy a bit. The high-level tagline is it's low beta, it's long short. Can you explain the investment process for listeners? And perhaps let's start with the size of the universe and how you filter that down to some investment ideas and position sizing.
We're equity investors. Our universe is Australia and developed markets, but primarily the US is the offshore market that we invest in outside of Australia. Mm-hmm. We use themes to filter that very big investable universe down to a researchable opportunity set. So we're looking for events or trends events or trends or buckets of alpha that are uncorrelated that would provide a place to spend some time researching. And the few that have been really good for the fund since we launched were, you know, the big one has been the internet taking share off traditional bricks and mortar businesses. Now, these aren't, we didn't invent that theme. It was well established when we launched. We've just been good at identifying winners and losers from that theme, whether they've been based here or offshore. So that led us to, you know, investments in companies like Alphabet early in the, or what Google as it was called back then, early in the fund's life. We've done well out of other tech stocks like Amazon, Apple, because of that theme. But there's been others on the short side, like the commodity price deflation theme was very strong and prevalent in the portfolio for the first 4 years. And what we do once we've identified a theme is go and look for the companies that have the best and concentrated, most concentrated exposure to those themes. And then we start with a basket of those stocks, and then we use our bottom-up analytical skills to high-grade the portfolio. Or Sam and Cam will say, look, we've got these eight stocks exposed to the Royal Commission fallout. I think we should be looking at stock 9, 10 and 11 for these reasons, and if they turn out to be, after our research, better exposures to, you know, the winners and losers of something like the Royal Commission or a slowdown in East Coast housing, they go into the portfolio and something, you know, a weaker exposure gets kicked out. And so it's a constant active management of a group of stocks exposed to either tailwinds for longs or headwinds for shorts. That's the basic process.
Mm. One of the trends, you gave that great tagline, which is bricks to clicks for some of those larger online plays, but another one which polarises people is the East Coast housing. How are you and TOTUS, how have you positioned yourself for that?
Yeah, we've probably been early, and we're often early. We were early on, you know, things like Blue Sky took a long time to play out, Quintus took a long time to play out. East Coast housing has been something that's been a bit of a graveyard for long-short funds. They've, you know, a lot of offshore funds have tried to short the Aussie housing market in various ways, and have usually, you know, not made any money or actually lost money. But we think that, you know, we're getting to the point here where there's a confluence of factors that, you know, we've got declining house prices in Sydney and a number of parts of Australia at the moment. The way we've been playing it is through retail, building materials and banking stocks, basically. The reporting season that just passed in August wasn't as bad as we had feared. But since August, we've seen a continuing decline or steady decline in house prices. No real pickup in auction clearance rates as we head into spring. We've got, you know, an election coming up in the new year and a potential change of government. So there's nothing really on the horizon that looks like it's going to stop that steady downward trend. The Royal Commission has been a very big impact on you know, the availability of credit, which is going to feed through to housing. So look, we went into the reporting season in August with a relatively, with a position short in all of those sectors. The results weren't as bad as we feared, so we covered some of those, and we're looking at adding those back as these headwinds are intensifying over the next few months. So, those are the three main ways that we're playing it.
I'm interested to know, before we get into more of the conversation on shorting, in your early days, how were you shorting? What instruments were you using to short?
It's always been, we've been lucky that we had a prime broker that backed us early. The agreement was that we would get to $10 million pretty quickly and break even, and it took us a little longer. So I was grateful to Merrill Lynch for taking us on as a very small fund when we started. And we were able to get single stock borrow on a very good range of companies through them from the early days. We now have two prime brokers, which increase our access to single stock lending, and we haven't had any real issues of getting stock in companies that we like on the short side of late. So as we get bigger, that may become an issue. The one that we would have shorted more if we could have got it was Blue Sky, but that was fully lent pretty quickly after the Glaucus report came out. But yeah, we've got pretty good access to stocks. Anything below 100 million market cap is a bit too difficult for us these days, and it's never really been a big part of our fund. We've really always valued liquidity very highly. Everything that is in the fund is listed and liquid and priced every day.
Yeah, there's one video that I saw of yours. I think you might have done it recently. You talked about the three sins of investing, one being gearing at a net level, excessive concentration and illiquidity.
Yeah.
Why are those three sins in your mind?
Look, I've been around markets a while, and I've seen firsthand a few funds that have got into trouble with gearing. Liquidity, you know, is a fluid concept, but, you know, stocks that look quite liquid when you get in or when you're a small fund, as you get bigger, or if the markets dislocate, they get a lot harder to get out of. And concentration works well, but can be, you know, very damaging if you get it wrong. So we've deliberately kept the portfolio diversified ungeared at a net level and valued liquidity very highly. So we have no more than 5% of the portfolio in stocks under 100 million market cap at any one time. And the real thing that was the killer on liquidity was seeing funds that had taken pre-IPO or unlisted investments that were small, and but then ran into performance issues, or the market had a drawdown, they had redemptions, and those small positions became bigger in their funds and became very difficult to price, and eventually ended up having to be distributed to unit holders. So if, God forbid, we ever had a terrible period at TOTUS and the investors all left, the person that's left with those dud investments at the bottom of the portfolio is me. I'm the second largest unit holder in the fund, so I'm very careful about keeping, you know, the bottom of the portfolio as clean as possible, with no illiquid names that we're going to get stuck in for the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an interesting point you make, that you are one of the biggest investors in your own fund. Would you ever invest with someone who wasn't a substantial investor in their own fund?
I wouldn't, personally. Yeah, I think it's very, there's a difference, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, boutiques have tended to outperform, you know, large institutional funds is that skin in the game and the 9-to-5 sort of, I'm not saying that managers at large funds work 9-to-5, but there is a huge amount of alignment and incentive in a boutique fund, not just in terms of the fee structure, but also in terms of, you know, the survival. Like, you really don't... you don't have 20 or 30 other funds that can carry you through a period of underperformance that are going to, you know, pay the bonus and get the kids through school. You really have to make sure every year is the best year you can possibly make it. So, yeah, you can. There's been a number of really good launches of small funds, but all of them have done well that I know of have had, you know, the managers as the initial, you know, largest investor or close to it, and they've kept plenty of skin in the game.
Yeah. It's, I suppose, not only is it born out in your own business, but it's born out in the way you invest when you seek alignment with management, so CEOs and executives of the companies that you're targeting. One thing I noticed looking through a lot of the material is your very sharp focus for quality, and I don't know if that's part of your experience as a chartered accountant, but perhaps you can explain some of the factors that you look for when you're assessing quality.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the starting point and the, you know, the source documents for us are really financial statements, and by quality we're talking about that the accounting laws allow you to present the business results in a number of ways. There is some discretion around the way that you can expense or capitalize costs, so run costs through the profit and loss statement, which impacts your earnings and price to earnings ratio, or if you can run them through the balance sheet, which potentially doesn't impact your earnings. We would consider running costs through the balance sheet more aggressive than running costs through the profit and loss. There's a bunch of other ways that you can, you know, fudge your earnings using perhaps acquisition accounting, changes in useful life or depreciation lives. So we just look at all of those little factors and try to look at, if we're looking at two companies in the same industry, we would tend to favour the one that has got the clean accounting, the more conservative accounting treatment, where cash flows tend to match up with EBITDA, for example, where, you know, one of the key things that got me thinking about ABC at ABC Learning was that the net debt was always higher than it should have been. So just doing simple sanity checks of, we know where the cash less the debt was at 30 June and 31 December. Where is it when they've done a deal mid-month? You know, does that make sense? There should have been some operating cash flow generated. Or a very simple piece of analysis that we do again and again and again is looking at what is the organic growth rate of a business once you strip out acquisitions. And that worked really well in a company like BWX this year, which has seen, you know, a private equity suitor walk away. They made a number of acquisitions, and we suspected it was because the core business growth wasn't as rosy as what the market was pricing in. And when we did that analysis of stripping out, you know, the impact of the acquisitions, it looked like the core business wasn't growing or was even going backwards. So looking at those kind of, just pulling apart financial statements and seeing, does the underlying business, you know, is it being presented in an aggressive fashion or a conservative fashion? And one of the only reasons management would use aggressive accounting to present their accounts is probably because the business is not growing as quickly as it used to, or there's some problem with the underlying business. So it's a really good lead into what's actually going on the ground. That's our starting point, but we do use lots of other things like competitor meetings, industry research. We look at research from our competitors, from the sell side, from independent research providers, you know, anything we can get that can give us an insight into what's going on in a business.
How about on management specifically? They're buying, they're selling, the skin in the game, alignment. How big of a part does that play?
Look, we don't sort of score it, but it certainly factors into our thinking. I mean, Smart Group's been our biggest holding in the fund for a number of years now. Mm-hmm. We've actually not seen any insider selling in that company since we've owned it, which is highly unusual. There's been buying from not just management but also board level, and we love when companies and management teams are aligning themselves with their investors. A lot of the businesses that we own have owner-driver-like characteristics and are taking a not just short-term view of a CEO life cycle. So we own a heap of businesses like Flight Centre, Beacon Lighting, even things like Amazon and Facebook, where you've got founders, founding families or CEOs who still have significant stakes in the business and are running those businesses for the long, long term rather than for the next earnings result, or to get a CEO through a 2 or 3 year vesting period for their compensation.
Yeah, it's certainly one that I think most investors need to pay attention to, is that alignment. And just having a quick read through, you can just even look at how many shares a CEO owns in their own company, and then follow on from there.
Well, insider selling, Owen, sorry, I should have finished up. Insider selling is a big red flag to us. And obviously people, at times in their life have to diversify, but where you see consistent insider selling in size in businesses that have aggressive accounting, that are expensive, that are facing headwinds, that is
too many red flags.
Yeah, that certainly perks our interest on the short side.
Yeah, you mentioned Blue Sky earlier on. I'm interested to know how that position came about. Some things happening beneath the surface, perhaps with valuation of assets and what you looked at.
Look, there's a few reasons we started looking at it. We've been cautious on markets for some time. We think markets are relatively expensive. Fund managers were beneficiaries of money printing and rising markets. They've had good asset growth. They've earned performance fees. And Blue Sky stuck out to us as a very expensive fund manager based on just a basic screen of fund managers in the Aussie market, and looking at things like price to earnings ratio or percent market cap as a percentage of assets under management. And then we started digging into it a little more, and it had a lot of exposure to multi-res apartments in Brisbane, which anybody that's been to Brisbane in the last 3 or 4 years would realise there's been a hell of a lot of apartments built up there. It seemed like a very crowded market. Their returns were very good. It's not easy to punch out 15% returns year after year, but they were doing it across 80 asset classes. So that, to us, was enough to do some more work. And then we're in the business of funds management. We know how these businesses work. If you're performing well and raising money, you're generally not going to be reliant on external capital to growth. To grow, these businesses have fixed costs, and they tend to spit out cash if you do your job. Blue Sky was in the market raising money every 9 or 12 months. So that was a red flag to us to start doing some more work. We were, a long time, ahead of Glaucus, it cost us a fair bit of performance in 2017, but a lot of those things that looked odd to us, have in hindsight played out, this year.
It's interesting you raised Glaucus, the notable short seller. Can you touch on your thoughts about reports and short seller reports that are put out in Australia, and if you think that they play a role? Well, they should play well.
Obviously, I'm completely biased as a we're long investors, and we do a lot of shorting. I'm about fairness, and I think that if somebody is allowed to have a positive opinion on a company, they should be allowed to have another person should be allowed to have a negative opinion on the company, and you tend to find that the good companies don't tend to worry too much about negative opinions. They tend to get on with their business, and if a short seller gets something wrong, we saw a report come out this year on Credit Corp, which was picked apart pretty quickly and dealt with harshly by the market. The stock ripped, and the person who put out that report probably took a pretty hefty loss, I imagine. So, I think certainly if people are spreading things that are unfalse or untrue, or making things up about a company, there's probably that's unethical, and there's probably a case to answer. But not everybody that likes a company that makes up things or talks about positives that never eventuate, that they don't get prosecuted. So, look, there's two sides of the story. I just think you should treat long investing or negative reports on a company, the same way. Now, Australia's got the added complication that we've got some pretty, strict defamation and libel laws, so it's difficult to put out activist reports or negative reports on companies, which is one of the reasons, we don't do it. But if somebody has put out a negative report that we agree with, there's nothing stopping us from saying that we agree with, their analysis or conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And if you just happen to be the beneficiary?
Well, our investors, what we're trying to do is really protect our unit holders' capital throughout the market cycle by owning high-quality cash-generative businesses. And if we can find lower-quality companies facing challenges to balance out that book, so, in months like this where the market's down dramatically, our fund is cruising along quite nicely because of that buffer from the short. So that's the reason we do it, is to protect our investors' capital.
Mm. I read somewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, something like the last 10 major market drawdowns, your fund actually outperformed eight times, or was positive? Is that right?
We were positive in 8 out of the 10. And this month it will be one of those 10 worst months since we launched 6.5 years ago. Market's tracking at the moment about -5, and we're at about -1. So we're not positive this month, but it's certainly good outperformance. So it does tend to be these periods where volatility picks up that our fund can put on large gaps versus, an index. Not that we track it, track the index, but many of our investors are equity investors, so they keep an eye on the index. Still got a couple of weeks to go, though, this month, so we'll see what happens. But, this month isn't atypical. It's a pretty normal month based on how the fund's performed in other periods of volatility.
Yeah, great. Circling back to your experience quickly at Pricewaterhouse, and as a chartered accountant, do you think that shorting is a viable strategy for someone who perhaps doesn't have those skills?
Shorting is a difficult one in general. Like, there's you really the reason that we've been able to do it well is because we've got a really high quality book of long investments against it, and we're highly diversified. We have 120 stocks in the portfolio, and the average position size of our shorts is pretty small. A very, very large short position for us would be 5%. So the average person doesn't have 120 stock portfolio. There is a lot of the shorts need to be actively managed. A company never goes from $100 to zero in a straight line. It's a journey, and you're sort of on the bus for periods of the journey rather than just going to sleep and waiting to get to the end, because stocks will whip around. Companies like Quintus or GetSwift or Blue Sky or ABC Learning have many rallies and peaks and troughs before they go down. So our job is to try and look for catalysts and times where you would want to be short, and for opportunities to take profits on shorts, and that tends to smooth our returns for the overall fund and protect our fund during periods of market volatility. So it's a bit of a unique skill set. There's not many funds that do a lot of shorting that have good long-term track records. So the reason that we're quite focused on it at the moment is that we're 10 years into a bull market. We've got a lot of expensive stocks. Now we've got some pretty obvious headwinds out there with trade wars, rising interest rates, and we think that's a good time to be spending time on our short book. But there'll be periods when the market is a lot cheaper that will have pens down on the shorts and be looking, most of the time for long opportunities. So at the moment, we're still finding it a bit hard on the long side in Australia in particular.
Okay. As a shorty, you need to be right on the company, but also right with the timing, right, because it costs you. I've looked at some of the recent monthlies you've put out, and one of the things that caught my eye was that you do have exposure to the mega caps in the US. So Alphabet, you mentioned earlier on. Why do you prefer to get that exposure to those large caps than here in Australia?
Well, it just happens that some of the strongest themes that we've identified, have the companies that dominate those themes are based in the US. But the mega caps we like because there's a huge amount of publicly available data on them, so we're not disadvantaged by being a small fund, based in Australia. We've got just as much access to research on Google as Fidelity does, for example. The other thing we like about mega caps in the US is that they have to report quarterly. It's interesting, just talking to investors, that a lot of investors don't seem to want to pay for those high market cap weights that they think that they can pay it. Play it better through ETFs or low-cost market exposure. And if we go a step below those mega cap names in, say, tech, and you look at the companies like Shopify, Zillow, Salesforce, Workday, there's a whole series of companies trading on very high multiples of sales that look wildly expensive to us, and we just haven't been able to justify getting them into the portfolio. But when we go to the mega cap end of the market, there seems to be some reasonable value on offer. So it just seems to be an easy place to research some very strong companies that are trading at valuations that to us look quite attractive relative to our own market and even other segments in the US market.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that one. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Okay, so let's move on as we come to the end of the conversation. TOTUS Alpha Fund has been going extremely well, performance-wise, but also from a risk perspective, as we touched on. Are you more, I suppose, you've got both of them, but are you more proud of the risk you're providing, the protection of the risk?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of funds that have, markets have gone up roughly 10% a year since we launched. We've done 21, but the thing I am proud about is how we've done that with almost no correlation to the Aussie market. Look, we did have one tough year in 2016 where we had two, meaningful drawdowns in the same year. I think we learned, some pretty good lessons out of that. And we did have a strong run through 2017 and the start of 2018. And now we've hit some volatility in markets and our fund is holding up quite well. So I think some of the lessons that we learned out of 2016 in terms of reducing gross exposure after a very strong run of performance, lowering our net exposure into a rising market, having longs and shorts within the same themes rather than being all long or all short within a theme, they've certainly helped the portfolio perform this year perhaps better, so perhaps we're learning a few things as we go.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so the fund is set up so that sophisticated investors only. How big can it get? How big do you?
Well, we're closing to new investors at $500 million, so we're at just over $200 million. Yeah. There's reasonable inflows at the moment. We're starting to get included on a number of approved product lists. If all goes to plan in the next 18 months to 2 years, we'll be closed to new investors. So I think we're very lucky in that we're independent. We don't have a big brother that's forcing us to sort of grow for growth's sake. We're not part-owned by a listed company, for example. We've got a relatively small but experienced team. So if we can get to $500 million, continue to punch out anywhere near the numbers that we've done in the last 6 years, it'll be a great outcome for our investors. And I'd much rather have conversations with investors about, good performance than tough conversations about poor performance having raised too much money.
Yeah, great. So where do you see TOTUS in 3 to 5 years?
Hopefully, you know, managing a sensible amount of money and punching out good returns and, you know, having fun with it as a team. And I still, you know, really enjoy coming into work, you know, most days, 9 out of 10 days. So, yeah, there's nothing else I really want to be doing for the next, you know, 15, 20 years. So it's really about just having a business that's able to, you know, I want to retain, you know, the great staff that I've got and have a business that's capable of attracting, you know, really top people to work with us. So that's it, trying to diversify our investor base, retain that staff and keep the numbers up.
Where can people go to find out more about you, the strategy?
Our website, Owen's got a fair bit of information. There's a couple of podcasts like today. We try to put that information out there. There is some third-party research on us, which if you contact us through our website at totuscapital.com.au, we'll be happy to send to you. Yeah, that's probably the best place.
Great. And final question, it's also my favourite. If you go back in time and tell a younger you just one thing about money, finance or investing, what would it be?
The key thing is taking a long-term view and starting. So they're the two hardest things to do. So best thing to do, you could do about investing or starting a business or getting fit or, you know, cheering up is starting. And if you can just take a view that is slightly longer than, you know, 6 to 12 to 18 months, which is most people's sort of time frame these days, there's a hell of a lot you can achieve. So taking that, say, 5 to 7 year view rather than the 1 to 3 year view can pay off massively.
Wonderful advice. Ben, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.